Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney. I'm the chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled A Valentine Call to Action for the Baby Boomer Generation. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events here at the club. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers, John Tarnoff, in conversation with Mark Friedman. John Tarnoff has been reinventing himself for much of his 40-year career. Fired 39% of the time as a Hollywood entertainment executive, he kept bouncing back, turning career setbacks into successes. When his tech startup went bust at age 50, he returned to school, earned an MA in spiritual psychology, and pivoted to a second act career focused on education, training, and coaching. This baby boomer career coach and author has written Boomer Reinvention, How to Create Your Dream Career Over 50. A love note to this generation, proposing strategies, steering them toward meaningful, purposeful, prosperous careers past traditional retirement. He lives in Los Angeles. Mark Friedman is founder and CEO of Encore Inc., Encore.org, a visiting scholar at Stanford University during 2014 and 15, a member of the Wall Street Journal's experts panel, and the author of four books, including The Big Shift, Navigating the New Stage Beyond Midlife. And now, John.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Hi, everybody. Good evening. So Mark and I are thrilled to be here. We're going to have a lot of fun. I want to do this in a fairly loose fashion. I've got my notes somewhere on an email here, and we'll just... I thought we would kind of kick it off talking about how we met, and this kind of frames the conversation a little bit about the subject of reinvention. Mark had written a piece, I'm not sure if it was the Wall Street Journal or the Harvard Business Review.
Yeah.
About the overuse of the word reinvention and how the concept of reinvention is overstated, hyperbolic, and misleading for people, that it raises too high a level of expectation, and that we should think more in terms of reintegration and other words with the prefix re. And, of course, trying to stake out a reputation as a reinvention proponent, I took umbrage at this and so fired off my own post in Huffington Post about this and why reinvention did apply. And Mark, within hours, emailed me, and we got into a conversation about this and became fast friends.
Yes, it's true, and I feel like we've been friends for decades. So when John said we could start the conversation off talking about how we first got to know each other, I thought it was going to be, you know, summer camp in the 1970s.
Right.
But it was actually this very awkward. I had a few years ago, I'd been on an extended family vacation. I've got three little kids, and they have five first cousins, and I had been cooped up with eight children between about three and seven. And so I holed up in a bedroom and wrote this screed about reinvention. John dignified it with the word peace. It does, I think the exchange though around that does bear some, I think what I was concerned about at that time is that this phrase was being used in very dramatic terms at a time when the job market was even worse shape than it was now. And so many people hitting this period in life, facing ageism, limited opportunities, and then being told to, you know, transform themselves. And there'd be, the invariable story about the person who was a lawyer one day, and the next day they were opening up a winery and the birds were singing and the clouds part and everybody lives happily ever after without breaking a sweat. And I think that, you know, that you're, so it did come off a little bit like you're supposed to just, you know, stick to your knitting. And I think your reaction to that really kind of opened my eyes to the, to a different kind of balance. And so can you remember what you wrote?
Well, I'm not sure. I probably should have pulled it up. So I don't really remember what I wrote in the piece, but I think the point that I probably made and would still make is that, reinvention is not for the faint of heart. It is not easy. It is not a snap of the fingers. But that in challenging times where the economy is in disruptive free fall and where every industry on the planet, it seems, is going through these kinds of transformations and insecurities and where management is in something of a panic about how to keep their businesses and their industries afloat, we have to upgrade our sense of what we're going to do about our careers. We can't just imagine that the way things have gone for us are going to continue, and we have to address this thing with a little bit more sense of commitment and purpose and perhaps challenge and discomfort.
Mm-hmm. Your discomfort point is well taken, too. It reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from Joseph Campbell, who said, midlife is when you get to the top of the ladder and discover it's leaning against the wrong wall. That precariousness in a way that so many of us find ourselves in at this juncture where the past approach to this period no longer obtains, but you're up on that ladder, and how do you get to the other wall?
Well, I'll see you're Joseph Campbell, and I'm going to raise you a Carl Jung. So there's a great Jungian analogy, which I include in the book, which is this idea of thinking of life as a sundial, and with each of us is the sundial in the analogy, and in the morning of our life, we observe the shadow that we're casting, but as the sun rises to noon, that shadow shortens. Until at noon, in the midpoint of our life, we cast no shadow at all and lose the point of reference that we have for who we are. And in the afternoon of our life, we begin to cast a shadow again, but of course, it's in a different direction. And if we are continuing to look for the shadow to reappear in the direction where we're used to seeing it, it's not going to be there. But if we pivot to reference the shadow as it is elongating, we're actually seeing an enrichment that is taking place over the course of our lives. And then, you know, poetically, as the sun sets and we lose the shadow, we merge into the night, we have built this awareness and this richness of that prolonged shadow. So I think that there's something wonderfully reinforcing about that analogy and that image. And I hope it gives us all inspiration to think that we're not done at this point in our lives, regardless of what a firing or a downsizing or a corporate reorg or buyout or whatever a euphemism HR is telling us to attribute our being fired to. There is more out there. And I think a lot of people at this point, having worked for 10, 20, 30 years in one industry, one company in many cases, are taken aback and discouraged by what's available. And then, of course, ageism is real. And there is a lot of talk about this. I mean, we're talking a little bit before about the Milken conference on aging, which took place recently, and a lot of the focus there was on ageism and on the ways that we can try to counteract this in our culture.
You raise a good point, because for so many people it is an improvisation, essentially a do-it-yourself process at this stage of life, which is why John's book, which is wonderful and has an even more yellow cover than my book.
Yellow's the color, right?
Exactly. But it reminds me, I mean, Jung, to pick up on what you were saying, he wrote an essay in 1912 29, or maybe it was 1931, on the stages of life. And there's this beautiful poetic passage in there in which he, it says, where are the colleges for 40 and 50 year olds like we have for young people that prepare young people to go into the middle of life? And as a result of not having these institutions and rites of passage to help people prepare for the afternoon of life, all too many people end up being stuck on the program of life's morning. And right. and then he goes on to say that, you know, if you've lived the afternoon of life according to that program, things are not going to end well. Right. And here we are in 2017, and we right. still don't have the kinds of educational opportunities that are fitted to this period of life, the kinds of internships. We may have Robert De Niro playing an intern, but
well, at least we have that, right? At least yes, they made that yes. movie, right?
Well, I was going to ask you, John has a very distinguished film career, and because he's a modest person, he doesn't, but he was the lead executive on Diner. He played a critical role in Animal House. So, you know, he's a serious guy. How is Hollywood doing on this front?
Terrible. In a word, I think we're doing terribly. You were down at the Movies for Grownups event earlier this week. There is a. I don't know. Are we going to do kind of an Oscars so old? Meme about this in the coming years? I don't know. I think there still is a lot to do. There's actually an event on Thursday night that I'm going to that Umana is sponsoring at USC about the portrayal of older people in movies and a discussion about this question. And so I think there is some awareness. I know that at the conference, people talked about the market and the realization that no one seems to get that boomers control something like 80% of is it 80% of disposable income or 50% of disposable income? It's a huge proportion of disposable income in our economy. Laura, you probably have that figure. 60. Thank you. Thank you, Laura Bitter, everyone. So, at some point, I think Hollywood is going to need to recognize this, although, just because they need to doesn't mean that they're going to, because that's not kind of the instincts with which that business works, and that's a whole other evening of conversation about that business. But I think more to the point about things that we can do something about, and that kind of awkwardly bringing it back around to the book, the point of the book for me was, and to your reference to the idea of the college for the last part of life, the point I wanted to try to make with the book was to give some practical tools, and if the tools, some of them tools may get it right, some of them may not quite be on target, but I think at least I'm trying to start this conversation going about, well, what actually can we do? What are the steps that we can take that are appropriate for us at this stage? Interestingly, I was in Seattle last night doing a talk, and there was a young man in the audience who's probably in his 30s, early 40s, and he said, a lot of what you're talking about tonight is completely relevant to me, and I don't think it's really necessarily about boomers. It's just about reinvention. And I said, well, great. I'm glad you feel that way. And I think that there are things in this book which are universal in application, but I think what makes it especially appropriate for our generation is the fact that we've been around a long time, and there are things that we understand just because we've been on the planet for 5 or 6 decades, which younger people just don't get yet. They just haven't gone through these experiences. And I think this is our strength, right? This is the ability that we have to reference all this. And we if we listen to the narrative, which is discounting it and painting us with these broad, very unfair, to quote another important government official, strokes, then we're going to kind of curl up and buy this crazy Kool-Aid that marketers, youth marketers, are trying to feed us. So I'm kind of getting into the weeds here. Help me.
No. I was thinking in your comments. So on the uplifting side, I had the opportunity to attend Movies for Grownups last Monday in Los Angeles, which is the 16th year that AARP has given out these awards. And I got to tell you, it was quite uplifting to see the turnout at this event. You know, Morgan Freeman, Denzel Washington, Helen Mirren, Jeff Bridges, Viola Davis. It really has become an important ritual in Hollywood. And what this language of grown-ups were real, you know, I found that people were very comfortable talking about themselves as grown-ups. Denzel Washington gave the last talk, and he described this as the service period of his life, service to God, service to family, and service to others. And he felt that The Fences, the film he's just done, was his service to August Wilson. And he had some beautiful lines. He said he'd reached a point in life where he wanted to leave the world better than he found it. And then he said that this is the legacy time. And he said, you can't hitch a U-Haul to the hearse. You can't take it with you to invoke a Hollywood trope. And I think there are a lot of people that are feeling that they're at this unique intersection between kind of vitality and mortality, to go to your imagery of the afternoon of life and what's special about it. Yeah. In your thinking about reinvention, what do you think is the unique opportunity of this period of life?
Well, it's a great segue talking about the period of service and the whole meaning and purpose thing. And we talk about this a lot in the Encore movement. It seems to be kind of like the header above the portico, the meaning and purpose trope, and it really is, I think, very simply that sense that, and I was talking to a woman about this last night, or a man actually, who was talking about his reinvention and how he had started this new company and it's kind of doing okay, but he's feeling something missing, and I said to him, is it the meaning and purpose question? And he said, yeah, I guess it is. I said, well, go be of service. Go find a service project. And you may not know where that's going to take you, but you may find the secret to your next move, whatever that is, from being of service completely without expectation of anything in return. And, you know, I think these are some of the things that we're kind of expected to do. We're kind of expected to be volunteering, and that's somehow going to take up all of our time, and that's going to be good enough for us. And I feel, just talking to you about this before we start, very ghettoized by this idea that, oh, well, old people should just, you're retired, right? So why don't you just go volunteer? And I feel very insulted by that, because I feel that it doesn't respond to very real economic needs that we have to earn money, the same way as anyone else who has got a brain and, you know, two arms and two legs who can, you know, add two and two, is entitled to do in our culture. So it's a lot of kind of work we have to do, probably on policy levels, but I think, you know, again, in the spirit of trying to be self-responsible about this and do what we can do about it, what I try to do in the book is to give us some way of starting that process within ourselves, so that we're not dependent upon a job description or on an interview, often from someone who may be younger, may have some innate misperceptions about old people and what we can do and what we can't do and how much we're worth and whether we use technology or don't use technology or whatever. And to base the reinvention that we're going to do on the relationships that we can develop and to be mindful and watchful along the way to make sure that what we're doing really has resonance for us, that the people that we're engaging with are appropriately responsive and that we can really build from there. So, these two ideas that really motivate or animate, I guess, the book are these ideas. One, that the that the career is inside you, that at this point in life, whatever it is that you've done, there is this well of knowing deep inside you that you may have, if you've been kind of locked in a corporate career for many years, that you may not be in touch with, but you can get in touch with that. There are ways of getting in touch with it. And then the other principle is that in order to create the future, you have to reconcile the past. You can't bring your baggage into the interview with you or the investor meeting or whatever it is, because they will read it and they will scope you out. And there will be something that is off because you're not completely committed to what it is that you're going to do. You're hanging back on a certain level, and you can't. You have to be completely resolved about anything, any bad experiences, any bridges that you've burned, or injustices that you feel have been done to you in the past. So there is a little bit of a behavioral psych tone to the book, although I'm trying not to kind of get away from it being a psychological book, and really making it much more of about a coaching book. So
let me ask you a question about that, because the past is, on the one hand, I feel like we want to have continuity in our lives and draw on these skills. And I suspect a lot of the skills that you developed in these earlier chapters are still valuable. On the other hand, there can be that perception of being stuck in the past, and it must be hard to navigate those two things. So I feel like a lot of the advice we're given is that we have to essentially lop off our past and disguise it. We have to remove all the dates in our resume so that people don't know how long it's been. And yet on the other hand, at our organization, Encore, we've been giving out the Purpose Prize for the last 10 years. Actually, today was AARP has taken over the Purpose Prize, and they called nominations for the Purpose Prize for the next 10 years. And what I was so struck by is how many of the Purpose Prize winners, even though they were doing dramatically different things at one level, were really so much rooted in their past. There's a guy here in San Francisco, one of my favorites, Gary Maxworthy, who created the Farm to Family program, and he had worked in the food distribution business his whole career, and then he became a Vista volunteer, and they sent him to the food bank in San Francisco, realized they were only distributing processed and canned foods, and he knew from his 40 years in the food distribution business that growers were throwing out fresh produce, and he knew how to actually distribute that. And so he created this remarkable achievement that last year, I think, gave out over 1 million pounds of fresh produce in California alone. But it was this great marriage of his past. But so many of us, I think, worry that if we even acknowledge these things that we've learned from life, we'll be considered over the hill.
Well, two things. One about the continuity question is very interesting. I think continuity is in the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. And don't lie about your age. Don't leave dates off of anything. Be proud of your age. It's their problem if they don't see your value. And if anyone in a career counseling position tells you to shave 10 years off your LinkedIn profile, take them out of your Rolodex, fire them, whatever it is, they're giving you bad advice, because you don't want to be working for anyone who doesn't value you. You don't want to have to be censoring yourself every day when you go into work and fearing this shadow of ageism that's going to come crashing down on you. It's not good for the movement.
I keep thinking of, to go back to the Hollywood, before I came over today, I went to see it. Has anybody here seen the show Younger? It's a 55-year-old Darren Star. It's in its third season. It's quite a good show, actually, with Sutton Foster playing this, I think, 41-year-old who's trying to pretend she's in her 20s so that she can work at this publishing house. So on the one hand, there's that. And then On the other hand, there was this great story in the New York Times a couple of years ago about, called Prematurely Mature. And it was about all these 30-somethings who were coloring their hair gray.
Right, right.
And and embracing their future self. And it right. was it was great. You know, when he loved his gray hair. He felt like it was really sexy. Somebody else had stopped doing it, though, because it took so much work. He said it was like having a pet. So I you know, you see some of the converging, but I think you're, you know, one of the great points among many in your book, John, is that we need to embrace this period. And I think everywhere, that's why I like the even the use of the grown-ups word, that's why, because we're often, even the language in this period is in conflict, the young, old, the working, retired, all these oxymoronic phrases. And I think we need a conception for this period of life, which your book lays out, that doesn't romanticize it, but it also embraces the real value.
Well, I mean, you know, I think in the I love the Big Shift because you talk about this kind of square on about this.
I thought you were a man of impeccable judgment.
and this idea of the period, and back to the question, the Jungian question about the education for this part of life. This is a completely different period. There has never been a period where people at this age had this ability for these few decades, these few extra decades that we've got to make the kind of impact that we can make. And we haven't, I think, begun to really scratch the surface of what meaning and purpose applied in the commercial world really means. We're still talking about it in the context of giving back and service and volunteering and social good. And it's great. And I love all that. I think it's a great place to start, but I think we need to get out of that room a little bit and really mainstream this so that no one is batting an eye at the idea that someone at age 70 or 75 in a corporate setting, and you see this around, and there's a great article in the New York Times this week about, you know, women in their late 60s and 70s who are still kicking ass, and, you know, the percentage, there's a higher percentage of women, older women, who are working than older men, and great. But this is, I think, still a curiosity and treated this way in the media. And that's okay. We're at the beginning of something, so let it start here. But I think this is a vector that we need to keep going on. And I don't want to forget this question of continuity, because I think continuity is dangerous, I think, for us to halt at this question of continuity and go, well, I want to try to preserve continuity. Or if I don't preserve continuity, then what have I got? You know, I've got to figure out how my skills can be portable to whatever it is that I'm going to do. And this idea that continuity is in the eye of the beholder, I'll give you a quick example of which is a profile from my book of a woman who actually is a friend of mine who I profile in the book because I just love her story. Her name is Marilyn Friedman. She lives in Oakland. She worked at DreamWorks with me. She was at the DreamWorks studio here in Redwood City. And had been in HR, essentially, in recruiting for 20-odd years with the company, had worked here in San Francisco in advertising, and then had signed on very early on at Pacific Data Images, which was the company that DreamWorks bought. And she became head of global recruiting for the company, but then was really kind of hitting the ceiling and decided that she wanted to leave, and she had submitted her resignation. This is around the time that I joined the company, and I was talking to them about getting involved in going out to schools and trying to recruit people out of schools. And they said to me, well, would you like to work with Marilyn and put that program together? And I said, absolutely. So we did this, and we kind of turned this into a great success at the company. And then I left the company for various reasons, another story, in 2010. She stayed on, continuing to run that program. They renewed her contract in December of 2013, I think it was, and then 3 months later they fired her. And she was devastated and very emotional person, lovely woman, daughter of Holocaust survivors from New Haven, Connecticut, just really, you know, down to earth, wonderful lady, had been with the company for 20 years, felt completely adrift, kind of didn't go out of the house for a month. They gave her an outplacement with a firm here. It was kind of strange for her to be in this room with other 50-something executives, all of whom had this same glazed-eyed look on their faces about being downsized. A lot of financial services people, Montgomery Street guys. And she started looking for work, eventually started going out, and got a consulting gig in the education and recruiting space with a nonprofit she knew the people. Got in there, realized that they were setting her up, that this was a complete power struggle between two opposing factions in this nonprofit, and she knew that she was going to be frozen out and blamed for something, and she quit after 6 weeks, I think. That was discouraging. And then she was approached by a startup, some people that she knew, kind of roundabout, DreamWorks, PDI, technology, whatever. Great, great job. Kind of a perfect job, except that it was a commute across the bay. Again, she'd done that for 20 years, didn't want to do that anymore. And there were a couple other red flags. At some other point in her life, she would have said, I'm just going to do it. But not this time. She decided that as much as she wanted the job, needed the job, she turned it down because she knew it would be a disaster. And that the management team hadn't really worked together before. It was too much of a startup. She knew that there was a great exit, but there was no guarantee. And there was that commute. And what they wanted her to do was going back to the work that she had done years ago. She didn't want to do any more on the HR side. She really wanted to be much more in recruiting. They said she could do that eventually, but she made, I think, the right decision, although every one of her friends said, are you crazy? You're turning down this job, da da da. It pays this money. These people are great people. You know, you'll work it out. And she sat for a number of months networking, whatever. And I'll come to the point of the story really quickly. Her husband, meanwhile, a food stylist, former chef, advertising agencies, you know, food stylists, people taking Instagram pictures with their phones, out of business, right? So that thing was disrupted. So he was going back to cooking. And he was the chef in the local elementary school. He had worked with, started signing on with a food services company that was providing services to the school district in Oakland. And he was the chef in the elementary school. And he comes home one day and he says, you know, there's an assistant kindergarten teacher opening. And you want to come in and meet the principal? And she thought, that sounds strange, but okay, fine. I'm not doing anything. Maybe it'll pass the time. It's part-time. She goes in, meets the principal, loves the principal, walks into the classroom, just adores the classroom. They don't have kids, this couple. Meets the teacher, signs on. Well, she's still there. It's a year and a half later. She loves it. And what she realizes she's doing, and this is about the point of continuity, she's doing the same job that she's always done, except she's doing it with six-year-olds. And she's getting in, as she says, she's getting in on the ground floor. And she's working in the same building with her husband. They've never worked together. They've been married for 35 years. It's completely transformed her life. And she's not saying that she's going to stay there, she's going to continue doing it or not. She doesn't know. But that willingness to step outside of that comfort zone and to give it a shot and to see where it could lead, and then to realize that it was so destined for her on a certain level. I mean, I get, you know, emotional just thinking about it, because it is the kind of epiphany that I think is available to us at this time that we could never have appreciated or strived for at an earlier age. And this is available. And it's available to us through, I think, a process of self-reflection, the willingness to reflect, the willingness to take that chance, the willingness to not know and to stand in that not knowing and allow the opportunity to find us.
I love that story. In fact, your aside about the firm, the transition firm that she, it reminds me of one of my favorite tales. I talked to a guy a couple of years ago who had been laid off. He was the head of CBS News, and he got sent to Lee Hecht Harrison or one of those.
Right. Sent to, like it's like going to reform school.
After, exactly, after being unceremoniously ousted at 60 and met a group of other 60-somethings who were in the same position, and they kept meeting afterwards. In fact, they formed a close bond, and they gave themselves a name, the Pip Squad. And I thought, wow, that's odd. You know, it sounds like one of the kindergartners in Oakland.
Right, right.
And it's for previously important persons.
Oh,
he said that their mantra was a perfect boomer reinvention one, too, which is the world may be done with us. Yeah. It's just we're not done with the world.
Yeah.
And but, you know, so many people who are in this position are turning to roles working with young people. So Lucy Kellaway, the wonderful Financial Times journalist, columnist for, I guess, almost three decades there, in November or December announced that she's leaving the Financial Times to become a math teacher. I think her daughter had been in the British equivalent of Teach for America, Teach First. And not only that, she was going to start something called Now Teach for 50, 60, 70-somethings who wanted to teach in science, technology, and math. And she instructed her readers to quit their job and to follow her into this pursuit. It's become this phenomenon in the UK, and one that really ties into the boomer call to action idea. Because I think one of the most promising routes is in myriad ways is turning our skills to helping the next generation thrive.
I mean, I think service is really the phase of life we're in. And I, you know, early on, I kind of came up with this analogy that if we grew up with the concept that the three acts of life were education, career, and retirement, that today those three acts, and I talk about this with my grad students, those three acts really are self-awareness, because education is lifelong, generativity, and then service. And that's the arc that I think we all need to kind of key into, and we're at that service stage. So, but it's not just service. It's not just volunteering. It's taking the wisdom and the experience that we have and applying that out. And it could be being of service to the fellow person in the next office, mm-hmm. you know, who is having a hard time dealing with a particular problem because they don't have the experience level of doing mm-hmm. that. They don't have the just thinking associated with being able to kind of snap into that solution. But it's not volunteering. It's really mm-hmm. support, and it's an important business asset that we have at this stage of our lives.
I love when I was talking to John about the session today, we were talking about this being it's the 50th anniversary of the Summer of
That's
Love,
right.
and
That's right.
he was talking about this being the autumn of life, and so we decided that this should be the autumn of love. And that we should announce it on Valentine's
That's
Day.
Right.
And I think, you know, you could say, what's love got to do with it? And I think, in a way, it's all about love and death, that, you know, famous Woody Allen title. Yeah. But I think that as we get to this point, and you become aware that life doesn't go on forever. Most of us do. You know, you go through these medical rituals and you wait for test results and you read your high school reunion notes and not everybody's there and it's not the people that you would expect.
Right.
That you realize what a precious gift this is. And yet at the same time, we have this opportunity to actually act on that insight. So I think that it oftentimes comes out through this desire for connection with particularly with younger generations. And I do feel like there is this service moment, but in the myriad ways that you're talking about, not just in traditional volunteer roles. So what would the autumn of love look like, John?
Wow. Well, what I was thinking about was when you were talking about the outreach I talk about three mistakes. I don't talk about this in the book, but I've talked about other places about the three mistakes that we make when we're out looking for a job. And the first mistake is our attitude. And a lot of people have this snarky attitude towards young people, towards millennials, and how entitled they are, and a lot of nods of heads, and they're lazy, they're not focused, we really worked hard, we knew the value of it, we didn't feel like we had to be in those meetings, why do they think that they have to be in the meetings? And these are our kids, right? I mean, they're kind of uh, they're coming at this really, I think, from a values perspective that we should be embracing. They're looking for work-life balance. They're looking for meaning in their lives already. They're looking for ways in which they can make a difference. Rather than dismiss them and belittle them and critique them, I think we need to be there to support them and to really help them to understand the value of what those principles are that we're talking about showing up and whatever it is. So, you know, of why their ideas aren't getting the same weight as someone who's been doing this for 10 years. And I have the good fortune to, in my day job, work with millennials every day, these grad students who are in their, you know, early to mid-20s. And I love these kids. These kids are just great. And they are fully conversant with these ideas about, you know, how millennials behave, and they joke about their own spaciness or whatever it is that is going on with them. But imagine if we were facing what they're facing, which is a much less certain world, a kind of a mosaic of reduced career opportunities in unstable economic times, a planet that is in really bad shape, leadership that doesn't seem to really get it. It's kind of a scary world. I think it's scarier than the nuclear threat and Cuban Missile Crisis and all that stuff and duck and cover and all the stuff that we grew up with. It's very different. Not to say that we didn't have our own stuff going on and our Vietnam era issues with leadership. But I think that just as we said, don't trust anyone over 30. I think it's time for us to kind of reach back out and go, it's time to trust people under 30. So that's my rant.
I just want to say that your rant is backed up by the facts. I mean, we are really, despite all the kids versus Keynes and this, you know, coming generational war that we hear about, you know, on a near daily basis, that actually this is the golden age of 60-something, 20-something relationships. The Pew Research Center has been for decades measuring affection between generations, and they've never seen levels like the present. We're at the highest levels of boomers and millennials living together since the 1940s.
Right. And you would 30%.
Think, yeah, you would think that would have, you know, if it was purely an economic phenomenon, it would have gone down as the economy bounced back, but the opposite's happened. Yeah. And you hear story after story of it. And I think it's a great, you know, the boomers.
And they love our music.
That I guess that's true. 8 Days a Week was one of the winners at the movies for grown-ups. And I've got a son who's learning Beatles songs. So maybe that's it. But there is, you know, when you think about it, so many of us grew up at a time that, you know, there was a generation gap. But in fact, it's really the opposite now. And I think that's one of the most important parts of our reinvention odyssey, is that we have a responsibility to figure this out for all these younger people coming on our heels who are going to live longer, who are going to reinvent themselves multiple times.
Yeah.
And we may not get it right, but at least we can help carve the path.
They're gonna be in this period, and they're gonna need to figure out what to do in their 60s and 70s. So we need to blaze the trail.
That's a good call to action, to blaze the trail. At Encore, we're in the midst of launching the Generation to Generation campaign, and I'm going to make an unpaid advertisement for it now. But, you know, as John was saying, young people today are growing up under much more stressful and difficult circumstances than even our generation did. And here's this vast growing resource of older people with a strong need to be needed. And not only that, it turns out that the secret to happiness in later life is not hanging on to our youth, but it's actually being there for those people who are young. I think, you know, we have a phrase at Encore, that the real fountain of youth is the fountain with youth. And there's research, there's a wonderful scholar at Harvard Medical School, George Valent, who's looked at happiness across the life course, and he's found that older people who mentor and are engaged with the next generation are three times as likely to be happy as those who fail to be involved in that way. And he says it's human nature that biology flows downhill. So rather than trying to be young, we got to go out there and be there for those who actually are, who are the future and who need us more than ever before. The truth is that it's really good for us too. It is the true route to happiness. And so we've launched this campaign in November, and we want to get 1 million people to stand up and show up for kids over the next 5 years to redefine what it means to be in this stage of life, and also to help this next generation thrive. So I hope you'll all rush home and go to generationtogeneration.org and help the next generation thrive.
I want to remind our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on the radio that we are listening to John Tarnoff and Mark Friedman, who are with us today on the subject of A Valentine's Call to Action for the Baby Boomer Generation. If you have questions, I would invite you to come to the mic in the back. We'll just check and make sure it's on.
My name is Becca Dubois, and I'm self-employed as a QuickBooks specialist. And one of the things I'm experiencing and hearing is that there's been huge leaps in artificial intelligence, and I feel like I need more data about mm-hmm. that.
Right.
Because at this point, what do I want to invest in order to make sure that I retain relevancy in this world of artificial intelligence and people more and more going to QuickBooks Online and mm-hmm. not really needing
right.
the kind of advice that I can provide. And so my question to you is there some sort of information gathering that sort of predicts out to the next 20 years, you know, where the jobs are going to be
right.
so that I can retrain myself right. and reinvent myself?
Well, I think I think it would just be safe to say that, yes, you're going to be automated out, right? Just kind of start with that assumption.
I'm already experiencing
right?
that.
And I think that's going to be true for a lot of white-collar work. It's already true, and I think we all have to expect it. So I think where the jobs are going to be or the roles are going to be will be more where people are needed, where people's empathy and support are going to be needed, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's all about psychology and coaching and counseling, but it can be about various levels of training and providing the wisdom that you have for doing this for so many years. And I would just encourage you to dig more deeply and to reflect on what it is that you love to do. What are the themes in your life that have given you the most satisfaction, where you feel like you've made the most impact on other people? I would ask your friends and your family and the people that you've worked with and your clients for feedback about how you do what you do and why it's made such an impact on them and what distinguishes what you do from what someone else has done. And gather that kind of deeper personal research about yourself. And let that process evolve and be open to where your interests take you. So they may have nothing to do with the particular aspect of financial services that you've provided, maybe a completely different avenue. I would just encourage you to think completely outside of that bubble that you've been in and see where that takes you, and give yourself months, a year, 2 years. It takes time to figure this out, but it's going to be worth it because that is going to help you sustain yourself beyond this automation Is there an apocalypse, way of saying apocalypse or something, right?
You know, this. I don't know how many of you saw the recent Thomas Friedman article From Hands to Heads to Hearts,
yeah.
And it's taken from his book Thanks for Being Late, and it's a brilliant piece. I'd really recommend you reading it. I mean, his argument is essentially that, you know, in the 19th century, being a craftsperson was the apex of achievement, and, you know, automation took care of that. And even knowledge work is being replaced by artificial intelligence. But ultimately, that the skill set of the 21st century is empathy and connection and relationship. And there's now a real accumulation of evidence that those are skills that get stronger with age. Emotional regulation, for example, a kind of key relationship skill, is something that strengthens over time. So there actually seems to be a convergence between the kinds of skills that are going to be required in the 21st century and that no machine can do, mm-hmm. and what older people possess and that flourish later life. So yeah. That's amidst a lot of concerning developments, that's one positive right. one.
And we just don't know. We just really don't know what those jobs are going to be. When you think about job descriptions today, admittedly we're probably going to go into another quantum level of empathy, people-related jobs, because we don't know what those problems are that are going to emerge out of the automation world that we have no conception of today. But I believe that there will be roles that will be worth getting paid for that are going to depend on this kind of awareness and ability to engage and to be strategic and critical.
And particularly with it working with the next generation, because, you know, for the first time ever now, we have more older people than young people in society. That's unprecedented in America, a country we've always thought of. Also means that young people are more precious than ever, and we need to do more and more to develop them, and I think we're the people to do it. So.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I take it to heart. One of the things I already know about myself, having 75 five-star ratings, is that people love the way that I teach them how to do. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I love the most is seeing the light bulb go off
right.
over their heads. And there's a point sort of midway in our session
right.
where that happens, and
right.
they are so happy.
Right.
And if I can find that outside of what I right. do now, that would really make me happy for the rest of my life.
I would encourage you to think of yourself as a light bulb turner-onner as opposed to a QuickBooks specialist, right?
Thank you.
Because you can take that turning on the light bulb to a lot of different places, right? Not just in that particular domain.
Thank you so very much.
Thanks.
Good evening. I see you both raising a lot of good points. One of the things that I run into as a baby boomer who's active in politics and climate change activism, a headline from the Washington Post: baby boomers have been a disaster for America, and Trump is their biggest mistake.
Yada, yada, yada. Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah.
No, it's a serious point, because if you're representing a movement of
right,
baby boomers,
right.
We not only have to deal with our positive aspects mm-hmm. and capabilities, but also the many sins that can easily be laid at our feet.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with the political legacy of, you know, Clinton has his good and bad points from my point of view,
yeah.
George W. Bush and now Trump, we've inflicted on the younger generation and the rest of the world. How do we get past that, take responsibility for it, own it, deny it? What do we do about this political impact?
Well, mm-hmm. I mean, I go yada, 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 because it's very easy to paint a generation with a brush, right? And this is, I saw that article, I'm seeing on my social feed daily a lot of boomer hate. And I think that the way to get around it is to just do what we do every day. And for every Trump that's in the White House, there were 700,000 people marching in Los Angeles, a lot of whom were boomers. There were, how many people, 400,000 people in New York who were marching. So what about those boomers, right? So I think that you got to you got to kind of choose your narratives a little bit here, and to say that a generation was responsible for an economic catastrophe is a convenient way of issuing blame, but that doesn't necessarily solve a problem.
I didn't refer to an economic catastrophe.
Well, environmental catastrophe. Whatever the catastrophe is that we're being blamed for.
Trump.
Okay. He's one man, right?
Well,
man.
we were the age group that mostly voted for him.
And sure. And then there's also okay, I'm not going to go there. I find your question frustrating because I don't think that we need to be on the defensive and take on ownership of Donald Trump and responsibility for Donald Trump, just as we don't have to take on ownership for who is a kind of a crazy entertainer from our generation I'm thinking of Madonna, who's probably a little bit younger. Is she a boomer, Madonna?
No, she is.
Yeah.
Okay. So Madonna at whatever the rally was, was she in New York or Washington, going, fuck you, Donald Trump, and fuck you. It's like, I mean, am I supposed to take responsibility for her as well? So I kind of reject this idea that we have to atone for Donald Trump. Through our actions, we are protesting Donald Trump. We may actually figure out a way of getting him out of the White House. He doesn't stand for the generation. He stands for himself.
I'll jump in on a couple of things. You know, I mean, I've been thinking about this question too, because Brexit also showed the same pattern. And I think the story on the boomers is still being written, and there is a very powerful counter movement of people who say this is not me, who are coming together and having a second wave of activism.
I don't think this has anything to do with age.
Yeah, I think that that both things are true, you know. Mm-hmm.
Stephen Miller is not a boomer.
Right. I think we have a responsibility, those of us who run against that narrative, you know, that the Post has really played that line up, you know, this monolithic narrative of what the boomers say, that's not the whole story or necessarily even the most important one. Yeah. But I think, when you look at Donald Trump, and I think I can say this as much as is possible in a nonpartisan way, I mean, he embodies the antithesis of everything that we've been talking about. I mean, here's a guy who in his 70s is desperately trying to hang on to his youth, right? With the orange hair and the boasts of virility and, constant succession of younger and younger spouses. I mean, he is, I think, the antithesis of the kind of wisdom and acceptance of this period of life. And I feel that in a way you can even look at his being an extreme version of this predicament that so many people in their 50s, 60s, 70s find themselves in, which is that they either have to hang on to their youth or accept premature senior citizenship status. There's no space to kind of embrace what's true about this period of life. And I think that's true in a lot of ways of a lot of the dislocated men who voted for Trump, who, you know, not only were left out of the economy in this kind of in-between stage, but even culturally, sociologically, there's not even an identity for this period. So I do think that there's something other than the boomer phenomenon that's going on and that we have to address.
I also think that every generation has its polarities, right? And if you want to talk about kind of Gordon Gekko Greed is Good as emblematic of our generation, sure, you know, it's one thread in a very multi-threaded story. and any generation. I mean, it's like we're talking about millennials before. It's like, are all millennials shiftless and entitled? No. You know, there's some really humble, hardworking, productive, visionary young people that are doing great things out there. So I really resist this idea of kind of characterizing any generation in any one way or using anyone as a defining spokesperson for that generation. It just we get drawn into this ageist, bigoted argument, and I think it's dangerous and it's a distraction from what we really can do.
I'll just say thanks both and yield to them.
Thank you.
Try and take us away from politics, if that's okay. So my question is around this period of time that we're talking about, whether there's even within our society recognition of that this exists, this period of time in your 50s and your 60s, mm-hmm. I guess, into your 70s. The business person in me says that before you come up with a solution, you need to define the problem. And if the customers or society doesn't understand there's a problem, the solutions that you present aren't going to have any weight. I think, Mark, in your book, you may have called it creating a category.
Yes.
And the category needs to be out there first before you do that. So your book has been out for, 5 years now?
Probably something like that.
So I
guess sold millions of copies too.
Right, okay. So the question is, have we made any progress at all in this? And if not, I think you brought up one example tonight already that's being done. But what more can be done to ensure that people understand that there's this category of people out there?
Yeah, the analog that I always think of with the predicament people are in today is that 100 years ago, we had all these young people who weren't children, they weren't adults. We were worried about them, because they had physical maturity, but we thought that they were emotionally immature, and we created this category of adolescence, and it took 50 years between that academic category and the teenager actually being born. And I think it is a long process as we kind of reshape the life course. But I think the problem is that a lot of people are they don't fit into any of the existing spaces that society provides, midlife, old age. And we get a population explosion of people in that period, and it's a time that could last as long as midlife in duration. And I think people have a hard time really coming to terms, as your book describes, with what's true about this period in life. And so this, 60 is the new 40, supposedly at the same time that you get, senior citizen discount at 50. So right. It's the old 80 at the same time it's the new 40.
60 is the new 60.
And exactly. And I think that I think it is a problem. I think we've got a large group of people growing who don't fit into the existing categories. And it's time to come up with something, though, that people can really aspire to. Not so much for the boomers, but really for all of these people coming on our heels.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks.
It's really hard. It's hard to know what to talk about. But my original idea, I would like to go back to the continuity topic. Now, I've been a massage therapist for 30 years. I went back to graduate school in my 50s in organizational psychology. So now I'm in a PhD program, and I want to get a job as a cross-cultural trainer. And I was freaking out and thinking, how am I going to sell myself to people when I'm coming from this world and going way over to this one? And then I realized I learned this term, transferable skills. It's huge. What have I been doing for 30 years? I've been listening to people.
Exactly.
And I've been listening to what they're saying and what they're not saying.
And you're healing people.
Exactly. So I have this huge listening skill, which generally is considered to be in short supply.
Right.
So that's my main point when I go to my interview and they're going to ask me for my best quality or whatever it is they ask you. Yep. That's one of my main selling points. And I think that we all have these things called transferable skills that even if we're going from one different thing to another, we have that thing, like you said, inside of ourselves that we can build upon, that we can use to deliver a product or an experience for someone that you can't buy.
Yep.
You can only get through experience and age. And that's the best thing about getting older. I mean, I could not do this job that I want to do now 30 years ago.
Right.
I think the challenge that you are bringing up is not about what are my transferable skills. It's how do I pitch it, right?
Yeah.
What's the narrative that I bring into that meeting that is completely authentic, completely settled, grounded, relaxed, outreached, that's just going to charm the pants off of anybody because I love this. I love what I'm doing. I'm so connected. I can't wait to share this with everybody. And that's the methodology I think that we have to work on to be able to, you know, it's like you're, you know, looking in the mirror and rehearsing that line, right, that you're going in. But to do that to such an extent that it's so second nature. And that's why I was saying before, 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years, to ground that. I mean, when I started this, coming out of DreamWorks, I'm going, okay, well, I really want to go to the next level of education and training and coaching. I started working for Carnegie Mellon. It was like really awkward. Said, well, what do you do? And I'm still feeling like I'm in the movie business. And it took me a while to be able to go, oh, I co-run a graduate program. And you're experiencing that same transition, but you know exactly where that's going to lead because you can see it, right? You can see yourself expressing that. So I think it's transferable skills, but it's also it's about a way of being. And that's the continuity to me. It's the way of being that we have. And now we're at an age where we can actually appreciate that and understand how everything that's come before has gotten us to that point. So it's not like, well, I used to do this thing, but it has no relevance at all to what I'm doing now. Just disregard that thing behind the curtain and just look at me now. No, it's not that. It's explaining why that past is so important and why it makes me so much better at what I do today. And why I can be the solution to your need.
I love this combination of old and new, too. I mean, I think that's where, I don't know how many of you have encountered this terrific TED Talk that Chip Conley, who created the Joie de Vivre Hotels, did on being a modern elder. And I feel like he captures that combination of transferable skills and new adventures. And in it, he talks about going from running that chain to being the head of strategy at Airbnb, but also mentoring Brian Chesky, who's the co-founder of Airbnb, and simultaneously being a kind of wise sage and having a beginner mind. And I think he's really on to something profound. And I think I would like to be a modern elder.
Yeah.
I'd like to have skills that transfer, but also really learn important new things from that platform.
Yeah. Yeah, because the beginner's mind, when you are an elder, the beginner's mind is a fantastic thing because you're a beginner, but you're bringing everything else that you've lived into that room and into that moment. So the beginnerness of it is so much richer.
Right. And your awareness of it.
Yeah.
It's so highly developed
because
how many times have we begun a bunch of different things?
Right.
Beginning again and again and again, whether it's a job or a sport or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. And I am totally convinced now that I can produce the result in the world that I want to produce.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's great.
Bravo.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Again, I want to thank John Tarnoff and Mark Friedman for their comments here today. After this talk, we'll be doing a book signing for Boomer Ta-da. Reinvention. So we hope that you will stay around for that. It's number one on the Amazon job category.
Deservedly so.
Yeah. No, it was. It launched. It's slipped a little bit since then, but at least it launched at number
we
one.
We also want to thank our audience here at the club, as well as our radio audience. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.